Okay, welcome everyone. Thank you for joining us this afternoon and our esteemed panelists, who I shall allow to introduce themselves in a moment. My name is Claire Lee. I head up the early stage practice at Silicon Valley Bank. And I'm also a very proud, not just a leader in that business, but also in the community. And we head up a lot of our most strategic partnerships for the company. I'm also delighted to represent SVB, who is a leader in a lot of the policy programs and progress associated with inclusion, with representation, and really supporting women and others in the community. And we believe very strongly in inclusion and education and representation across the board. So I am very proud and pleased to represent Silicon Valley Bank and have such amazing partners on this panel with me today, talking about forging new pathways. And I must admit, I am somewhat still shaken after that incredible lunch speech from Viola Davis, and also with Cara, seeing Madeleine Albright and Condi Rice. So, you know, it's kind of a hard act to follow, I'll tell you that. but, you know, we have big shoes to fill, and we are going to try and do it, myself and Jimmy Choo's. But it's also important, I think, for us to be able to share other personal stories, as well as the ones that you've just heard over the lunch hour or two. And we are really pleased to be able to talk about a couple of topics in the next 45, 50 minutes before we open up for questions. Some of the themes that we were asked to talk about include the culture of disruption in the context of forging new pathways, and also about risk-taking, which is always, you know, kind of a prickly topic, especially, you know, from a European, where apparently we're very risk-averse. And then the context of diversity, whether we are indeed getting more diverse, less diverse, and how, you know, everything is shaping up. The other thing I like to talk about is actually solutions. So in the context of everything we are talking about today and what we're hoping to come away with today, inspiration, inclusion, and certainly more solutions. And I think that's a really important focus for us in this room today. And then we're going to really, you know, try to leave everybody here with a call to action. So forging new pathways, I'm very pleased to welcome the panelists from four different spheres of the industry. Shilly Galili, a dear friend of ours and partner for a long time, heads up UpWest Labs, nurturing, incubating, and investing in Israeli companies, bringing them here to the Valley, helping grow very successful companies with remarkable Israeli founders, male and female, and some incredible female founders as well coming out of that cohort. So welcome to Shilly Galili.
Thank you.
And I'm going to have the panel talk a little bit about themselves too. Elizabeth Gore, another remarkable human being who happens to be female, amazing person, very much a pioneer and a leader as well in the industry. Currently the entrepreneur in residence at Dell. And we have shared a couple of interesting stories and events together in our time as well. So I'm very pleased to welcome Elizabeth Gore. And then I'm going to jump to the end before I come to Les, because he's really special, as you can tell. we like boys, too. Laura Kennedy joined Techstars fairly recently, working with a good friend of mine, Don Loeb, at Techstars, who is an incredible person, amazing advocate for women and progress and diversity and inclusion. He heads up an amazing policy and corporate development business for Techstars. He's part of the leadership at Techstars that invests very wholeheartedly in this next generation of founders, especially women entrepreneurs. So I want to welcome Laura Kennedy, who's representing Techstars. Last but not least, Les Matthews from MasterCard, who is kind of, you know, his story really resonated with me when I read it, and I'm delighted to have him here today to share his story. Welcome to Les Matthews from MasterCard. So, without further ado, I'm going to start asking some questions, and then once we have asked a couple of questions of our panelists, we will open it up to you for questions, and we hope that you will be asking a lot of questions. We want this to be interactive. We want this to be a dialogue. No monologues up here, so I need to stop talking pretty quickly, actually, for that to be the case. So, Shirley, tell us a little bit about, you and UpWest and, your personal story. I mean, Forging Pathways, pretty relevant for what you do and what you've done. You started UpWest, was it 2012? So it's still fairly new, but in that time, you've incubated and invested in over 60 startups, I think. Pretty incredible what you are doing, what you've done. You know, give us a sense, if you will, of like how you have forged pathways yourself and how that has come to be, because it's not an easy path.
Talking about in 2012, identifying a certain disruption, both in the industry as well as, I think for me, I was already connected to both ecosystem, both in Israel and here in the US, and working with a lot of the tech giants and finding opportunities for investing and acquiring Israeli technology. But what I noticed that kind of was brewing under the surface a lot was a real pain for Israeli entrepreneurs, because if you think about it, they built incredible technology. They are very, very innovative. They are ambitious, but their market is miles away from where they are. They're very isolated in that sense. So when they build a technology, they're very limited in having access to their customers, and they're very limited in the perspective that their customers have. So when I identified that in 2012, there were already some vehicles for investments, and there were already some vehicles for trying to help entrepreneurs at the very early stage. You don't need a lot of funding to start companies these days. So that's when we set up UpWest Labs, because we felt that if we provide an opportunity for these brilliant entrepreneurs to spend significant amount of time near their customers, they'll move faster, they'll be more successful, and they'll be able to capture very quickly a lot. So that's when we set up UpWest Labs. I had very little experience before in, creating a fund and managing a fund and having to raising a fund. But I was so, I so believed in that mission and in being able to help these entrepreneurs to really realizing their dreams that, we totally kind of took on the challenge. And I think that already in the market, there were great vehicles like Techstars and Y Combinator. So that kind of vehicle was really timely. So personally, for me, it was a great opportunity to be kind of at the forefront of creating something for a certain unique ecosystem, and also within that to really identify brilliant female entrepreneurs that we could also include in that vehicle. And so feel very privileged to be able to continue and do that today.
I mean, you talk about it like it's easy or straightforward and it kind of just happened. I think we know it didn't, right? It's not magic. So why do you think you've succeeded in creating a company, a business, a vehicle, fundraising, investing in companies with exits and returns and successes and a lot of follow-on investment where a lot of others have failed? What is it, do you think, that you personally have been able to adopt that's made you, succeed and make that possible for you?
Well, I think that, let's see if this succeeds. We're very grounded in, what we're doing. And I think that, the way I look at it is the way every company or every fund or everyone looks at it, right? I mean, differentiation is one of the most important thing that you need to do. And for us, we had me and my partners already kind of an advantage in understanding two ecosystems. We really understood how to take companies from one ecosystem into the other and identify those talents. It's heavily curated. And so we wanted to do something that no one else is doing, serving a certain thing that other people are not serving. And by really being focused and differentiated, just like I think everyone should be trying to find out, we were able to very quickly, build a certain path. And it helped us to continue and build on top of it. And we constantly checking ourselves every year and every few months, are we still differentiated? Are we still really on that same path and mission? And if there's anything that we need to change and shift, we should be doing that, because I think that what we don't want to be is to be just another fund doing the same thing for the same type of people around you. So I do believe in that as a path to succeed.
Well, I think you're being modest, because you do say we a lot, but a lot of it is you. So congratulations on what you've built so far, and we do wish you continued success with that. Laura, you've moved from DC to the Valley very recently. You've also moved from a company where you were doing M&A, Living Social, for quite a while, to move to Techstars. So it's a lot of change. It's a lot of movement. Do you have a perspective on the difference between, say, DC and Silicon Valley or San Francisco? When it comes to a culture of diversity and a culture of disruption, are there aspects of those two that you can see already in a short time that are very different?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there are differences, but I believe that innovation can happen anywhere. So Silicon Valley has a pretty established ecosystem to support innovation. Techstars is on a mission to really develop the world's best ecosystem for entrepreneurs to start a company and bring new products to market wherever they live. We have 26 programs. That's across about 15 different distinct markets in the US and increasingly worldwide. I think, here there are systems, there are experts, there are mentors that are a stone's throw away that could really help a founder or help somebody who's trying to navigate something internally get the advice they need. In places like DC, it's not as widely pervasive, right? And so you really have to have a platform and have leadership to start to curate that community and to bring people together. And so both private industry, companies like Living Social, really were a home base to grow a lot of local entrepreneurs who came out and who are launching new companies in the ecosystem. So startups breed other entrepreneurs. And it's a collaboration with local government that you see there, who's also trying to invest in programs, as well as just people who self-identify and step up to say, I want to be that leader, right? The other thing that Techstars has, and this has been really transformational in my life, in my career has been increasingly entrepreneurial. I started out in investment banking, went to a big company called AOL to do M&A, acquired a lot of startups, said I want to join a startup. I joined Living Social very early. I was in a room with 30 people. In 2 years, we were 5,000. And a lot of that was my work going around the world, meeting entrepreneurs and helping us scale through acquisitions and bringing other entrepreneurs on this rocket ship. And one of the things that was really helpful to me is my expertise was in deal making. Certainly at a startup, you get exposure to a lot of other functional areas. There really aren't silos. People don't have defined roles. It's really messy. And there's a lot of beauty and certainly learning in that mess. But I also went to a startup weekend in 2013, which, I had an opportunity to judge. And I said, no, I want to do this. And 56 hours, you're in it, right? You're in the process. You're in the journey. It's super humbling to have an expertise in one area and feel completely silly where I don't know how to launch a landing page, but you learn, right? And so Techstars has, I think in 160 countries or something, a startup weekend or a startup program that's running. We run over 1,000 events a year. And so programs like that are certainly helpful and instrumental in places like Washington, D.C., to really start to cultivate that community, to help you not just have the learning and to develop both the skills and experience as well as the empathy of how to think like an entrepreneur, but also to start to build out your network. Find those other like-minded individuals, those other beacons of light who you could start to gather with and transform your local community and ecosystem.
Yeah, I think, I mean, Startup Weekends, through my own experience as well, are an incredible platform to have lots of diverse people collide, where otherwise you never would, right? And work together on real businesses, real ideas, real companies. And talking of platforms, Elizabeth, you've had a really fascinating career. You're now obviously at Dell as an EIR, and you're also involved very deeply in building a new platform for female founders, women entrepreneurs through the Circular Board. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, your journey? And it's had really incredible chapters with the United Nations, et cetera. What brought you here? And more importantly, what are you most excited about what you're doing with Circular Board?
Sure. Well, I grew up on a cattle ranch. I don't know if anyone else did in the room, but it's very relevant to what I do now. Not really. But I actually was in the UN for 10 years, and that was my career path, and I loved it. And but I saw very quickly that entrepreneurs were the ones really making sustainable change. And I know this is a hot topic now, but I spent years working in refugee camps and saw that women particularly and men would develop a small business out of nothing to feed their children and their families, and just got really super obsessed with entrepreneurs. And whether there's a micro sense of at a camp, or it was back here in the States and seeing the sustainable change that bigger entrepreneurs or those being funded can make. If you look at Elon Musk in energy, or you look at any of the systems that can be really changed for the long term, I find that the ones that are profitable are the ones actually that will really save lives in the end. So towards the end of my tenure at the UN, I met Michael Dell, and he actually shared the same purview that entrepreneurs save lives, and both of us really focused on that, but felt like there was no unified voice for entrepreneurs. And there's no trade association for entrepreneurs. All the highs and lows y'all go through every year, the policies that impact you. It's really hard to hit Congress or the White House or, you know, here in the state capitol, and then, you know, in 161 countries where we work at Dell, really understand what entrepreneurs need. So I had the pleasure of joining as an EIR, but I call myself a high-paid intern because I'm not a technologist, but I do know that with technology, anyone can really be an entrepreneur if they have access. And how do we need to advocate that, you know, different, whether you're male, female, whether you're in any country, a marginalized citizen or minority, you have the opportunities to do that. So our actually first big piece that was super relevant this week that we ended up passing a couple of years ago was the first UN legislation for entrepreneurs to ensure that every country made a commitment to create jobs and help entrepreneurs. And you would think that that would pass easily, but it took us a year and a half because of the gender lens, because there's still a vast majority of companies that are countries that vote at the UN that was not behind it being equitable for either gender or minorities in their country. So a lot of people think this stuff is, all of it is very probably intuitive to you in the room, but it wasn't to a lot of these countries. So that was kind of our first big thing that we did. And then now we're really looking at gender and trying to understand these gaps and these numbers that haven't moved with women entrepreneurs. And even though women are creating these businesses and y'all are kicking ass twice as fast as men sometimes, so we actually just, to your point, made a significant investment in a company called the Circular Board, based out of Houston, Texas, which is an ecosystem for women entrepreneurs. And we're building a full digital platform for women to search based on your industry, stage, and geography, everything you need to scale your business. And so that's being built up at Pivotal Labs right now. And I just joined the board, and I will tell y'all, it's really funny to be in a leadership team at an enterprise company like Dell with 200,000-ish employees and then a company of 8 at the exact same time. But I do think that both can impact significant change when you look at diversity inclusion or profitable solutions. And so for me, I'm in this really cool spot right now between the two, and both frustrate me. It's like two kids, you know. So for me, this has come full circle of, you know, going from being at the UN to straight into enterprise and entrepreneurship, and now really investing in supporting companies that have purpose-driven outcomes. So it's a ton of fun. Yeah. And now I'm a Californian, which is really exciting.
And you're here, yeah. I'm so here. You're that's a very powerful partnership.
I still wear my boots mostly.
I know. I've seen.
So I dressed up for y'all today. So
thank you.
You're welcome. So
I am very cognizant of what we just heard from Madeline and Les. You know, she talked about these mega trends, globalization and technology, and the way both of them have, you know, positive powers and facets and negative. But in a way, what you're doing in the realm of fintech is pretty relevant, right, with both globalization and technology. So you're in a very exciting space. You've also had an incredible journey yourself personally. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what it was like growing up in Oakland and a few of those like kind of micro chapters to, you know, here you are, right? And you said in your own words, I didn't think I'd end up here. Clearly surrounded by, you know, fabulous women, right? But we're glad to have you. So tell us a little bit about that journey, because it's quite fascinating.
I do a lot of these. This was a little intimidating, actually.
Good.
For obvious reasons. But I'm usually not this nervous, so indulge me a little bit as I sort of get the story out, and I'll try and be fairly succinct. I was born in East Oakland and raised there for a good part of my life. And I had a really, you know, non-traditional journey, but when I was listening to Viola Davis, I was like, man, that was a journey, right?
Yeah.
You know, you've got to own the story. But, you know, to give you a few tidbits, I didn't have a great family life. I was put into foster care kind of on my own volition, right? Because I left home at 10, and that's what I did. And I was in and out of foster care for several years. And right before I turned 16, decided I could just do this on my own. But I did have some very positive influences, growing up, even in foster care. And most of those positive influences were women. And they were people who recognized something in me that I didn't recognize in myself and encouraged me to pursue it. And I sort of bumbled my way, finished high school, went to college for a couple of years, dropped out because I didn't have a clue what the hell I wanted to do or what the hell I was doing. And I worked around the Bay Area mostly for 4 years, just doing stupid little jobs that paid the bills. And I can remember on January 25th, 1995, I drove out of Oakland, headed east, because I figured finishing college was a good place to start. And I left, and by the time college turned around in the fall, I was in a school in Atlanta, and I went to school, and then I went to grad school. And I was telling this story to someone the other day. The companies used to come and try and get you to intern, and, you know, I was always a good interviewer. So I had a few opportunities, and I literally picked the highest paying internship just because I needed the money. And that's how my career started in financial service, and that company was American Express. When I reflect and I look back and I say, you know, I've had a lot of success, I've had a lot of people whose shoulders I've stood on along the way, and that's really important. And I reflect back, and I moved back out here. I've been with MasterCard 8 years, and they moved me out here 2 years ago. And it was January 25th, 2015, almost 20 years to the day that I left. And, you know, I got to come back and, you know, sort of see this story full circle. And, you know, I get to work with amazing people, and I hate being vulnerable. some of them are in the crowd, my team, and but I get to work with amazing companies. And so, you know, having come out here and, you know, been asked to sort of develop a team and develop a presence and do MasterCard's work in the digital space and work with large companies like Amazon and Facebook and Google and Apple and work with lots of small startups that most people have never heard of in VCs and accelerators. And that is really, really amazing work. And I see how it fits into our corporate vision and our corporate culture, because we're really strongly galvanized around inclusiveness around the world. If you've ever heard our CEO speak, he's just an amazing person, and this is something that is not lip service for him. It's near and dear to his heart, and being able to build those relationships and add value to not only to our company, but to other companies and to individuals has been a really amazing experience over the last couple of years.
Well, we're very pleased to have MasterCard as a partner as well in what we're doing, what we're building for, you know, early stage startups through the Commerce Innovated Program. I'm going to kind of shift gears a little bit because I wanted to address some of the things that we've been asked to talk about and some of the things that I heard this week. One of which was Juliet Kayyem, who was part of, you know, Homeland Security and actually sat on the National Security Council for a time, very articulate woman, said yesterday, sometimes disruption is a mask for incompetence. And I found that really compelling, and it really made me stop in my tracks and think, what does she mean by that? And I thought, you know, is it true or false? I mean, nothing's black and white, right? Elizabeth, in the unique place you're standing, which is at the intersection of so many areas here in the ecosystem, do you think that disruption is a mask for incompetence, or do you think it's a positive manifestation of innovation and creativity?
Not to put me on the spot, I love disruption. So you just asked the wrong person, probably. But we actually just did a study, and it showed that over 50% of enterprise companies are preparing to be disrupted by startups. And that's really telling that a Fortune 100 company is looking at the startup ecosystem because they might be better than them. And I think that's really exciting because I think disruption brings efficiencies. It brings new ideas. I also think disruption lets the little guys and gals come barreling in where they wouldn't normally do that. And so I also come from a place of humanitarian work where I think disruption is so important. New ideas, new solutions, and the only caveat I'd give with it is I would say organized disruption. Okay. So I do think that those who will scale and not just disrupt and poop out are the ones that are going to have the long ball. So I might have a really crazy disruptive idea, but I have a plan to scale it. So so I'm a huge fan of disruption, both from a social standpoint, but also from an economic standpoint.
Shirley, what about you? And obviously, there's a lot of cybersecurity solutions coming out of Israel, and it's both encouraging and often scary, right? Because you think, wow, some of these solutions are built for real problems. The problems are real and big. What about you? Do you think that the disruption we're seeing has a positive force ultimately, or are there aspects of it that you feel are indeed, you know, to Juliet's point, kind of masking an incompetence or hiding something else?
I think that the way, you know, the way I look at it, and definitely the innovation coming out of Israel comes because of scarcity of a lot of things. Yeah. Security is definitely something that, you know, we grew up with over there, and we have to constantly build defense software and mechanisms to protect. But also, if you look at the innovation that comes out because of scarcity of water and agricultural tech. And so what happened in that small piece of land that, you know, is so threatened by a lot of things, there's also lack of natural resources, and that caused the population to seek innovation and to build things that, first of all, will take care of its own, but then take it to the mass market. And I think, you know, that's what I feel is, you know, taking an opportunity for something that is lacking and creating something that then you can take elsewhere. And so we've seen that over and over again, and I think we're continuing to seeing that. Cybersecurity comes out of Israel for, you know, the obvious reasons. A lot of the technology is being built for the military, and then later on the teams come out with new software that then, you know, gets to protect MasterCard and, you know, other companies around the world.
So when we think of it, you know, Madeline said globalization technology, again, looking at, say, the area of M&A, which you're in, Laura, I mean, is it, again, are you bullish about the future? Clearly, you know, you've moved into a really interesting company. Techstars is working with both startups and the big corporates that we hear are going to be buying more of the little guys, right? So M&A is on the increase, strategic investment and venture capital is on the increase. So these are great indicators for growth. As part of that, do you feel there's more kind of openings for female entrepreneurs? Do you feel like the you know, the needle is moving at all in this area in your career? I think you've seen, you said you saw a shift. Is it a positive one in terms of seeing, you know, women create more startups that then get acquired by the big corporates?
Yeah, so I'm with Elizabeth in terms of being for it and optimistic, right? There are words and there are meanings. There is talk and there is action. So when it comes to disruption, or diversity for that matter, it could be a big buzzword that you lob onto, or you could actually take the action. And to really effectively execute, you are accountable to your customers, to your investors, to your employees, right? So like, you can't actually be and get too far being destructive if that's really your intent, unless you have those riding with you. And, you know, I think we see a new wave where there's a fundamental foundation that's been set in terms of technology, in terms of entrepreneurial frameworks. We're also seeing completely massive transformation in the platforms that we will use, right? We just opened our eyes and hit mobile, and now we're looking back at mobile and looking into AR, VR, and new technologies. So I am long for the future, because I think one thing, particularly as it relates to women, and maybe I'm projecting a little, I think what has differentiated me from a deal-making perspective is really bringing heart into a deal as much as head, and being ruthlessly collaborative. Because when you're bringing companies together, whether it's through M&A or business development or joint ventures, any point and intersection for collaboration, it's that same level of accountability, right? You have to look each other in the face at the end of it and say, I am being good to you, right? You are my partner and we're in this together. You don't get to cut and run. And so in that context, both from the platform shifts where you're going to see a lot of traditional industries transform, but you need the expertise, right? So look at auto, for example, or smart homes, right? There are a lot of established industries where you're going to need both the existing players as well as entrepreneurs who are bringing new, fresh thinking, the ideas and that talk, right? But also the action and the stakeholders with them on board to really push things through. So I think it's a good outcome and time for all entrepreneurs. I think women who are looking at opportunities that no one has seen before, maybe they're in industry already, right? And they want to be an entrepreneur, or maybe they're ready to really step out on their own and bring people along with them for the ride. I think it's a phenomenal time.
I'm glad you think so. I mean, everybody here is very positive. I think we can just very quickly touch on this notion of risk. So if we were to each, in a quick elevator pitch, say, what is the one risk that you've taken in your life, personal or professional, that has really paid off, that's led you to be sitting here next to us today? Laura, start.
That's a really good question, because I've stopped looking at my life as, I've reframed the context of everything from being the destination to the journey. So I think when I was in destination and like ruthless goal mode, I got a goal or I didn't. If I got a goal, then I was not happy and got the next goal. And I sort of missed out on the point of everything that I did, because when you failed on goals, you missed out on it. So I look at it slightly differently in terms of what are the little risks that I take every day, as opposed to, we're not the result of one big thing, mm-hmm. right? We're the choices that we make, we're the result of thousands and over time millions of little decisions and little choices. And so it's always, you know, in that broad theme, I think it's choosing to be me, even when me in an investment bank or an M&A capacity at a big tech company did not look and act and think like everyone else, still being who I was and bringing that and not being afraid is probably one general overarching theme.
Not being afraid, Les, that's not where you are today. I mean, you're very brave, you're courageous, you're here, you're vocal, you're, you know, a pioneer in this area. What is the one thing that you can share with us that you think of as a risk that has paid off?
Well, I think I alluded to it, actually. I think the risk that I took when I was 10 years old, and to say, this is not how life is supposed to be, recognizing that as a 10-year-old, I don't know how I did it, and walking away and seeking refuge, that changed the trajectory of my life completely. Had I stayed in that moment and stayed in that environment, I don't think I would be sitting on the stage today. And that has led to a series of additional risks that I've taken over time, of course, both professional and personally. But that's that one moment in time that I can point back to that I think has, like I said, changed the trajectory of my life.
So you said seeking refuge, and refugees is quite a topical thing right now. Elizabeth, what is that one thing for you that kind of, you know, when you hear others here, you know, talking about this and the notion of risk, what is that one thing that comes to mind for you?
So for me, it's definitely been jumping, I guess you would say, sectors. So I went from agriculture, you know, heart of Texas. I went to school for animal science. I was supposed to come back and manage our ranch. I was only got to go to college. I was the first woman to get to go to college so I could come back and manage the ranch. So explaining to my mother that I was going to the Peace Corps instead was about the scariest thing I've ever done. Anyways, but I pivoted from that to Peace Corps and UN and did quite well and am very proud of that. But then I pivoted again and went to an enterprise job, and now I'm pivoting again and going to entrepreneurship. And each time I was doing very well, whether it was personally, professionally, financially, so it didn't, I guess, make sense, particularly to folks around me. And the generation, I think, above us are not used to us going, oh, I'm going to run for office today, or I'm going to go humanitarian tomorrow, I'm going to go for profit. It's usually you're pretty straight up on one path. To me, it's been very clear because one led to the other in my own learning, but each time it was literally, you know, you're crazy, you're going to go broke, you lost your network. And I thought that in my own head, but then you hear that from people around you as well. And I've been, it's usually like a 2-year holy shit transition. What do I do? What did I do? But then I'm in the holy shit mode right now. Going, leaving Dell, going help. Back into the startup world probably. But anyways, probably each one of those has been to me the biggest risk. And it was a risk because, you know, when you walk away from a pension and to do this or that or move towns.
Yeah, so it takes a lot of courage, that movement and that ability to pivot. Mm-hmm. Shirley, I mean, I think you get to take risks every day because you're investing in companies. Tell us, for you, what is the one thing that really comes to mind when you think or hear the word risk?
I think I'm kind of a combination of all of these people because I moved from a different country. And I think that a country that, you know, from there to constantly go and look for and seek places where you're not comfortable. I think that if you're comfortable in what you're doing constantly, you're stagnant, you're not learning. And for me, it was constantly trying to go and go to places where I'm outside my comfort zone. And definitely being in a different country was my outside my comfort zone. Previously, which I forgot to mention, we all are drafted into the military, so I did serve 2 years being an artillery instructor in the Israeli Army and had to, at 18, already be outside my comfort zone, you know, working with men mostly. And so leaving, you know, for the US, going into the nonprofit sector, which I was in for probably about 12, 13 years, working with NGOs, then, you know, running the California Israel Chamber of Commerce, and being in kind of a very different world, although constantly around new ideas, new initiatives, raising funding for probably social impact type of things. And when the opportunity came to go and do this, you know, what I'm doing right now, which is investing and taking risk on companies, it didn't seem like such a big leap for me. I mean, it's kind of a different mechanism in terms of, you know, the structure of it or the funding and the money and the upside of it. But I think that I looked at it and I thought to myself, I'm really not stopping doing what I've done in all of these places that I've been before. And that is putting both your head and intuition together in order to evaluate a particular startup or a market. And then think again, you know, am I too comfortable? Is this my comfort zone? Where else can I go to learn more and to do, you know, more things? So constantly finding that need to be challenged. I think that's where the best risk taking is.
Well, before we move into questions, start taking some questions from the audience, I just want to give a very quick example of how Shuli defies convention and addresses the risk element in the room, because just before we arrived in here for the panel, we left the remarkable luncheon speeches with Viola Davis, Madeleine Albright, and Condi Rice, and we had approximately 6 minutes to get from that room to this room that we couldn't find. On the way, I really needed the restroom because it was over 2 hours of not having a restroom. And so we see this long line when we finally find the restroom because we were a bit geographically challenged. And, you know, there's this huge line outside the women's room. Then there's a men's room next to it. She goes, hey, there's a men's room over there. Smaller line outside the men's room. Okay. I go to the back of the line for the men's room. She said, hey, you're a speaker? You need to ask them, can you skip the line and go to use the restroom because you're going to be late? What's wrong with you? You're Irish. I'm like, yeah, okay. So I couldn't do it. You know, it's really interesting how I just didn't have the cojones, okay? So there is a lesson for me immediately in how Shuli just, you know, she sees it, she does it. In a split second, she didn't care about embarrassment or anything else. She's like, what? None of these people know you.
It's called chutzpah.
Chutzpah.
That's chutzpah. What it's called.
All right. So we've learned about chutzpah. Thank you today for that, Shuli. It really was a relief.
Awesome. Big relief.
Literally a relief, yes.
Literally and metaphorically. So we are going to actually open up for questions. Before I do, I just want to say thank you to everyone for sharing your stories. For being so personal, so professional, so vulnerable, and so remarkable. Thank you for everything that you do and for sharing what you do. Okay, I'm hoping there are questions. I'm trusting that there are a few. I don't know how we do questions here, but...
Oh, there's a microphone right there.
There is? Wonderful. Come to the microphone. And will you start, please, by saying your name and where you come from and then asking your question?
Sure. Hi. My name is Becky Bosman. I have the distinction of working with Nancy Duarte every day on helping leaders with communications challenges. And I am fascinated by the role that empathy plays when people are communicating through times of intense change or when they're trying to get a bold idea to really catch fire. And so my question is abundantly selfish as a lifelong student of that, but I hope that everybody in the room will benefit from hearing some of your answers. I would love to know how each of you personally perceives empathy playing a role in the way that you've been able to move people in your career as you've ascended into the roles that you play today, as you're deal making, as you're business building, as you're nation corralling and herding. You know, it's not lost on me that anthropologically speaking, women are known for having empathy as a stronger characteristic. There's a lot of evidence for that. And frankly, it's also evidence that anyone who has risen through to the ranks of success from other than traditional and privileged stories also have a lot of empathy. So I would really value hearing what you all think about that. And thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for the question. Empathy and communications and, I guess, you know, respect is part of that for people who have an opposing view. Who wants to go first? Laura?
No problem.
You're going first.
Funny, you should ask. No, I was actually wondering this. Where does that come from? You know, I think for me, I'm the first person in my family and only person in my family to go to and graduate college. I, prior to college, was on a plane twice. 2 months within graduating, I was flying in a G6 with an investment bank, right? So I have a lot of range. My you know, growing up was in a car, right, just driving up and down the East Coast. That's how we vacationed. And it was wonderful. Nothing was lacking. And I think it really just comes from, again, aligning, you know, your heart and your head and bringing both to the process, really listening and actually listening, not thinking about what you're going to say, but listening, not just to the words that are being used, but, you know, when you're sitting in a room with someone and sitting across the table from them, what is their body language saying? It's hard for me to talk about risk because I work with so many founders, and to me, there's no bigger risk than that, than to just go out and make that decision. And selling their company or working with a larger company in a more strategic capacity is really scary. It's exciting, but you are about to give up some control. And the other side is really worried that maybe things don't work out and they went to bat for you. And so just understanding where there is fear and trying to infuse it with hope, right, and love and optimism and vision and excitement about what you're really there to do, which is grow and build value together.
Those are wise words for the kind of times that we're seeing at the moment. Les, what about you?
I think about it in a couple of different ways. I mean, you know, my upbringing, I think, sort of triggers an empathetic bone in my body, especially when I see people who have had similar upbringings. But it's not limited to that. When I sit across from people, whether it's colleagues or other businesses or partners or whatever, right? What I'm looking for is authenticity, both from myself and from them. And if I can, you know, feel that authenticity, you know, my empathy kicks in, right? Because it's something there to say, you know what, this person isn't a narcissistic, lying jackass.
But they're authentic about it.
Right. They're an authentic person who, you know, has real challenges despite where they come from, right? I think I lost my mic a little bit. There it goes. They're real people who have authentic challenges despite their upbringing. And is there something that I can lend them to help them in that moment? And, it used to be when I was, you know, years ago, when I would do some speaking to schools and things like that, I was really focused on people who had a similar story as mine. But then what I started to realize as I became a little wiser and a little older is that everyone has their own unique journey. And you can't judge that journey. And despite their upbringing or their background, I mean, I know lots of friends who were privileged that are miserable, right? I'm a pretty happy guy. So it's about how do you leverage, you know, that to be able to share, how do you get to that spot, that place of happiness? And that's what I try and focus on.
Thank you. Shirley?
What I do is really invest in very young teams, and there are typically 2-3 entrepreneurs. Can you hear me now? Typically 2-3 entrepreneurs. Sure. And what I've seen with, you know, some of my colleagues in the investment community, and a lot of times it's seen as a very kind of a transactional act, right? I mean, you write a check for someone, they're starting a company, and I think, you know, the way I've learned to look at it, it's very personal. In the end, you're investing in people, and so I think that a lot of times we do need to look at what we do as it's a people business, really. We are there to help. We are there to listen. We are there to learn. And I think that bringing that to what we do every day is not only, you know, nourishing the person across from you, but also yourself. And what oftentimes happens in very early stage startups is a lot of drama. You know, founders don't get along. There is a lot of stuff going on, and I often find myself, you know, having to be that person that, you know, has to sit and listen and mediate and oftentimes, you know, look for advice. And and it's very important to have that empathy, I think, in what we do.
Elizabeth? My one comment is technology does not have to take away empathy. That we acquired a company this year called Pivotal that is the fastest growing software company that builds out software. And the coders and the engineers, so probably the most deeply technical folks who are, a lot of people would have blanket over them that they can't communicate, they're just too smart.
Female CTO too.
Yeah, well, our the CEO of Pivotal actually does an empathy test for every hire.
Wow.
At Pivotal. They have 3,000 employees, and most of them are engineers and in coding. And he says because the code is ultimately about the end user, who is a human, generally.
Okay.
And so...
Not for long.
So he actually believes that they have surpassed other companies like them because of this empathy test. And wow. That these folks can actually communicate. And he said he would take the person, and this is a joke because I'm from there, from Texas A&M versus Harvard, if they can actually communicate better. So I just think that's interesting.
That is fascinating. Yeah, I mean, the point about globalization was interesting with this progress. You know, a lot of, they talked about how a lot of things are becoming faceless, and then we're losing our identity, and hence identity is being made up for in other ways, and maybe not so positive ways. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty fascinating how technology is playing such a role there. Any other questions?
Hi, I'm Charu. I run a startup called NextPlay that builds automated mentorship programs for women at large companies. And Les, you and I were chatting a bit ago about how there are some things that you can know about confidence and leadership, or some things you can do that accelerate your career. So my question to each of you is, what is one specific and actionable advice for us you can give us? Something that you did that your peers did not, or maybe something you did better than them, which has led you to have an accelerated career path? And how about we start from Claire?
Okay. Well, my one piece of advice is just always be true to yourself. It's a head-heart combo, but for me, when I ignore my instinct, I get in a lot of trouble. And if I have an instinctive reaction to something, it's usually right. My first instinct is usually the right instinct. And if I don't speak up, I usually regret it. So my one advice, the one thing I've learned in my career that's really, I hope, helped, that I've noticed, is really being true to that instinct, sharing it in a way that hopefully is not, you know, divisive or intimidating or negative, but just saying, here's what I see, here's how I feel. Do what you like with that information. But if I'm not true to myself, I pay a big cost every time. So I'm trying to do that less these days. Yeah, great question. Thank you for putting me on the spot. what about you, Laura?
I keep putting Laura on the spot.
No, it's great. I would say give, right? So I think my leadership style is one that is serving and really to help the people around me shine and to remove obstacles in their life and to be helpful. And so I think, you know, find the thing that you're great at and share that with someone else, because you can't really learn about leadership. You can, but you can't, it's not an intellectual exercise, right? It's a lived beingness. And so to actually put it in practice through mentorship, I mean, Techstars would not survive if not for our mentors, right? That is a huge part of what really helps our entrepreneurs accelerate and thrive. And so find what it is that you're good at and give that. Find what you're not so good at and seek someone who could give it to you. And when you learn that, teach that as well, right? And just continue that cycle and find new areas, whether technical skills or, you know, human and interpersonal skills, to continue just to practice, learn, absorb, and then give back and repeat that cycle.
Les?
So I'll kind of focus on, you know, sort of my recent history, which is, I have just a really really maniacal focus on talented teams and hiring talented people. I said to you, my success is the success of others. And, you know, I have what is undeniably one of the most talented teams in our company, and if I would put them up against any team. And I'm really, really focused on hiring the right people, because, you know, I wouldn't be successful without them.
But how do you keep them?
That's difficult. It is challenging to keep talented people because they're going to get poached. And sometimes you have to let them spread their wings and go, and then sometimes you have to write big checks to keep them. You do your best, but, you know, honestly, I think that there's a relationship aspect and a loyalty aspect that I also sort of try to develop and curate, and I think that's hedged off some of the poaching and people leaving. And I think that's what I focus on.
Good for you. What about you, Elizabeth, and the this big lesson, if you like, that you could share?
I would just say manage your network. So, like, it's your cash. I mean, your network will be with you through every job, company, personal, professional. Make sure you give back to it as much as you take from it. I'm surprised. I mean, your network actually should be part of your calendar, your business plan, what you focus on, put time into it. It will serve you dividends throughout your entire life, but also make sure you give to it, not just take from it. So I think not just networking, but your network is, I make calls to people from 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so it will be the thing that will set you apart from people around you, I think.
That's a great piece of advice.
But make sure you're good back to it, because otherwise it doesn't work.
Yeah. Shirley?
I must agree with that. I think the network is, you know, super important. And a lot of people say that, you know, creating a network is important, but actually maintaining a network is something that is really hard to do, especially in this day of age that everyone is on social networks. But really the core relationships that you build with people around you, and whether it's mentors, whether it's colleagues, whether it's, you know, people who are peers, because that's your support system, and what gets you through kind of the rough days of whether you build a business or a startup or you're building an organization. And it's always important to lean on that. I think that's what I've learned.
Yeah, I would totally reinforce that. I think it's like a living organism. It needs constant nurturing, like watering a begonia. When I was young, I let a lot of begonias die. These days, I'm a little better with my plants. Yeah. Any other questions before we wrap up?
Hi, my name is Katie Anderson. I am a grad student, final semester.
Good job.
And I have the privilege to work at an early stage startup that was actually started inside of a startup weekend, which, if you have never done a hackathon, do it with startup weekend, because it's exhilarating, exhausting, and so much fun.
I didn't plant her.
Don Loeb, did you give this lady money to talk about that?
But my question is, there's so many paths towards entrepreneurship now that were never really possible even when I did my undergrad 11 years ago. And I see all of these great companies coming out and disrupting larger ones. But my question is, what is the next or foreseeable path towards entrepreneurship that maybe is starting to arise but hasn't quite gotten there yet?
Okay, so this has to be real quick fire answers. So we're going to go Laura, Les, Elizabeth, Shirley, 20 seconds or less. Go.
You're not going to like this, but I think there's no answer, right? I think the two quick takeaways I would say are entrepreneurship is not going away, and it will continue to, both on a standalone basis and well as being integrated into larger organizations, into policy and government, I hope, right? Mm-hmm. To really continue to innovate and reinvent that which was. But kind of to put a pin in what Viola said, I think really it's owning your story. How founders come to be is really remarkable, and I feel so fortunate to work with close to 1,000 companies and their founding teams to really learn their journey and their story. And founders are not
you know, the only entrepreneurs out there, right? It could be in other organizations, it could be in nonprofits. And so I think it's just owning that identity as an entrepreneur as part of your story.
Yeah, I would sort of echo that. You've got to carve your own entrepreneurial path, which is, you know, find a problem that needs a solution that you can disrupt. And that's a great path to entrepreneurship. Don't be a me-too entrepreneur. Be a unique entrepreneur.
It's the reason I started this whole journey is I think you're going to see entrepreneurs as the social change agents. And they're in the whole like social entrepreneurship thing will go away. So whether you're profitable or not, I think you will see in every country, whether it's, you know, an emerging economy, a marginalized economy, or where we're sitting now, that you'll see entrepreneurs tackling the biggest social challenges, not just governments and humanitarian organizations. I mean, they're doing it now, but I think you'll see a rise of it. I also think we're going to have different types of funding start to emerge, which I'm really excited about for entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm.
Julie? I think that, you know, there's no better time to start companies, and definitely from 10 years ago, which was much more difficult. You needed so much funding, and most entrepreneurs came from kind of one particular path. What I see today is, and this is where there is a lot of opportunity for definitely a lot of women to come into entrepreneurship as well, is people disrupting anything from, you know, architecture to agriculture to government and healthcare. And in all of those fields, there are problems to solve. And so, you know, I feel very optimistic about this.
Well, me too. Thank you, everyone. Thank you for attending. Thank you very much, Pamela.
Thank you.